Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Musk-Hawain. 5 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the financial meltdown that followed, the Federal Reserve signaled that economic recovery is not as robust as it had hoped. The Fed took many by surprise last week when it decided to continue with its stimulus bond buying program. The continuation of the $85 billion a month program is seen as a sign that the economy is not healthy enough to begin the weaning process and still needs the monthly infusions. Is the U.S. economy really recovering? And if it is, why do so many people have yet to see it? This hour, we take a look at the state of the economy 5 years after the financial crisis that led to the Great Recession. We'll explore the Fed's decision, the search for Chairman Benjamin Bernanke's successor, and the prognosis for economic recovery. Joining us is Binyamin Applebaum, a Washington correspondent who covers business and economics for the New York Times. Binyamin, welcome to Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
And also with us is Jim Tankersley, economics policy correspondent for the Washington Post. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, lots of questions here. Binya, I want to start with you to ask if you were surprised by the Fed's decision last Wednesday to keep the stimulus program in place a while longer.
I was surprised. I think a lot of people who follow the Fed closely were surprised by the decision, and that's in part because the Fed had sure sounded in recent months like an organization that was getting ready to pull back. Officials had talked about their sense that the economy was doing better, that we were reaching a point where they could begin to wean it from their aid measures. They sounded almost excited about doing that. And so when they came out and said basically, you know, hold on, we're not ready yet, we want to wait at least another month and maybe even a little bit longer than that, I think a lot of people were taken aback.
Why do you think they made that decision?
But I think, you know, you summarized it well on the way in, which is, you know, that they basically are not convinced that the economy is there yet. Bill Dudley, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who's one of the leaders of that policymaking committee, actually just said this morning in very clear terms that he does not yet have confidence that this economy is growing fast enough to deliver the job growth and the economic growth that we want and that we need. And as a consequence, the Fed said, you know, we're going to keep on trying. We're going to keep on injecting stimulus into the economy in the hope that we can make things a little bit better.
Binya, would you explain for us how that program works? So it's $85 billion a month in bonds, right? Some mortgage, some treasury. Explain for those of us who are non-economists how that program works and how it helps to, in fact, stimulate the economy.
Yeah, you know, probably the easiest way to think about all of this is that, in general, the Fed has one basic lever. It can make money more expensive or it can make money less expensive to borrow. And when it wants the economy to grow faster, it makes money less expensive to borrow by pushing down on interest rates. The Fed has a normal, traditional way of doing that, which affects short-term interest rates, the amount that banks pay each other to borrow money, say, overnight. But that only indirectly affects the loans that you or I might actually take, like a car loan or a home loan or that a business might take to build a new factory. So in recent years, having pushed short-term rates all the way down to zero, the Fed has also tried to directly affect the level of longer-term rates, to directly make mortgages cheaper, to directly make car loans cheaper. And the way it's done that is by basically providing funding for those loans. When the Fed buys bonds, what it's basically doing is providing funding, going out to the market and saying, basically, we are willing to fund auto loans, to fund mortgage loans in particular, more cheaply than the market was previously funding them. It forces other investors to accept lower interest rates for their money as well, and it makes that money available to consumers and to businesses more cheaply than it would otherwise be available.
Is there reason to believe that it may only be another month that this is in place, or do you imagine that this could be several more months or taking us into next year potentially?
So it is clear that the Fed will still be buying bonds next year. The question is, when do they begin to reduce the level of those purchases? And in June, the Fed's chairman, Ben Bernanke, had said very clearly that the Fed intended to begin to cut back by the end of this year. And they only have a couple more meetings this year, so that made it sound like we're going to be getting there pretty soon. He came back just, you know, earlier this month and said something a little bit more cautious, which is that it might be this year, but it might not. And so I think we have a lot of uncertainty at the moment about when the Fed actually will begin to pull back. Probably the key variable, the key thing that may end up determining that, is how badly Washington behaves in the coming months. The Fed is really concerned that Congress and the administration in this latest standoff over budget policy, the possibility that the government will again shut down or that the debt ceiling will be breached is going to once again disrupt this recovery and once again force the Fed to keep stimulating the economy for longer than it would like to.
Well, and we know that, I guess it was Friday, that the House passed a measure that would tie continuing government spending to defunding Obamacare, or the government could shut down.
That's very provocative because the administration has said in point-blank terms that it simply won't allow a budget deal that does that, that defunding Obamacare is simply not acceptable from its perspective. And so, you know, when House Republicans do that, what they're basically daring the administration, they're basically, it's a game of chicken at that point. They're basically saying to the administration, we're going to do something that you say is absolutely unacceptable. The ball's in your court. And it makes it that much more likely that the government will end up shutting down as a consequence.
Jim Tankersley, do you believe that that will happen, that we could see at least a partial shutdown come October 1?
I think anyone who bets optimistically on this Congress and this environment in Washington is making a bad bet right now. It's just not looking good. Now, in the past, we've seen some pretty clear avenues to compromise. It was fairly obvious that one side was going to give, for example, in the fiscal cliff fight at the end of the year last year. It's pretty obvious that some taxes were going to go up, and the question was, where were they going to draw the line? That's not the case here. It's pretty hard to see where the compromise point is between defund Obamacare and don't defund Obamacare. So the question will be who blinks first and how much can one part of the leadership, perhaps the House Republicans, perhaps the Senate Democrats, convince the rest of its rank and file that it needs to go along with a compromise position for the good of the country or for the good of the party if it appears that, you know, one party is being blamed for shutting down Washington.
Binya, what do you say to that? What are your thoughts about the possibility of something really happening October 1?
I mean, I think there's a good chance that the government shuts down. We've seen it. You know, it has the virtue from the perspective of politicians of being something that they have done before and that didn't cause the country to collapse. So they think of it as sort of a viable negotiating posture. The other big decision that Republicans in the administration are facing is whether to raise the debt limit, which is a federal law that limits how much money the government can borrow. We've almost exhausted that borrowing authority. It needs to be raised. If that doesn't happen, it could cause the United States to default on its debts. There is a pretty broad consensus that that would be genuinely catastrophic, and so that's a bad place to have this fight. The consequence is that people who really want to have a fight about government spending, you know, the idea of a government shutdown, by contrast, seems relatively more palatable and therefore is, you know, something that might actually happen. It's made more likely by the fact that they can't have this fight about the debt ceiling. And I think, you know, there's a genuine chance that someone who wants to make a statement is going to insist that the government shut down for a while to make that statement.
But I would just add there that I'm not sure that there is a general recognition in Washington that they can't have this fight on the debt ceiling. I think, in fact, you could end up seeing the opposite, where it's rolled into the debt ceiling because the Republicans, for example, end up yielding because they can't get an Obamacare defunding measure through the Senate. So they yield and they pass a continuing resolution that funds the government for some amount of time, and then they roll all of their energies into one big fight over the debt limit, where they do feel like they might have a little more leverage because the president can't afford to let the United States default on its debts, in which case you basically just upped the pot in the middle of the table in this high-stakes poker game with the national economy and fate of millions and millions of unemployed people sitting in the middle.
Pretty scary scenario you're painting, Jim.
That's what I do. As Binya knows, this is my way of looking at the economy in Washington right now.
It never hurts to be a realist, right? Getting back to the Fed, Binya, has the Fed taken a hit in terms of its credibility? As you pointed out, the chairman was signaling months ago that it was likely that the program would begin to taper off, the bond buying program that was stimulating the economy. And so now here's this decision on Wednesday that surprised a lot of people. Is there a question of credibility at this point?
There really is, and it's important to understand the context, which is that the Fed, once it reduced short-term interest rates to zero, has relied primarily as a policy tool on trying to convince people that rates will stay near zero for years to come, because that's your only way to lower borrowing. If you think about the cost of a long-term loan as basically being derived from the level of short-term interest rates, not just today, but on every subsequent day until the loan is repaid, then the best thing you can do if you're the Fed is convince people that rates will not just stay low today, but that they will remain low for all of those subsequent days. That has been the real focus of Fed policy. And that's entirely an exercise in credibility. You're basically going to the markets and saying, hey, guys, trust me. I promise I'm going to keep rates low. You have to believe me. Go ahead and bet your life savings on the proposition that I'm trustworthy and that I will do what I say. And for the Fed to now come out and surprise markets, it's a really unsettling thing for a lot of investors because they are, to a greater extent than ever before, betting that the Fed is trustworthy and predictable, and they are dealing with the reality that, you know, circumstances change and the Fed is not totally trustworthy and the Fed is certainly not totally predictable. And it really unsettles the Fed's ability to stimulate the economy by making that kind of promise.
Where has that left the markets in the wake of this decision, Binya?
Well, you know, markets have been on a surprisingly, you've seen a little bit of anxiety reflected in asset prices. So, you know, in the wake, when the Fed started talking about this in May and June, interest rates started to rise. Investors said, hey, it looks like the Fed is beginning to pull out. We're gonna start reacting to that kind of talk. And then when the Fed came back last week and said, you know what, we're not pulling out just yet, investors did not return all the way to where they had been in May and June. They didn't say basically, okay, let's go back to that world where we're confident the Fed is going to be sticking around indefinitely. They sort of ended up somewhere halfway in between. They basically don't believe the Fed as much now as they believed the Fed this spring.
Jim Tankersley, is it likely, in your view, that the decision about tapering off this program will fall into the hands of Bernanke's successor?
I would be surprised if the next Fed chair is the one who begins the tapering. I think December still looks pretty likely, assuming there isn't this massive breakdown in the economy because of what happens in Washington in September. On the other hand, if there's even a big hiccup because of it, I absolutely could think that the next chairman will end up having to deal with the question of when do you scale back the asset purchases and how quickly.
And it looks like that next chairperson could be Janet Yellen, correct, Jim? At least she's the front runner at this point.
Janet Yellen, current vice chair of the Fed, a very distinguished academic economist and a former chairwoman of the San Francisco, president of the San Francisco Fed, a very long time rumored to be one of the top two choices of the administration. And then when Larry Summers, who was the top choice of the administration, bowed out under some pressure, she has clearly emerged as the front runner. I'm not sure when we will hear. The very, very likely we're going to hear that she's appointed, but I'm not sure when that will be.
We want to talk a little bit more about the potential successor to Chairman Bernanke. We also want to talk about the economic recovery and whether it is real for many people. What do we know about the housing market? What do we know about household incomes, those kinds of stats? We'll talk about that and much more, and your calls as well, when Radio Times comes right back.
The American Philosophical Society Museum supports WHYY and presents Through the Looking Lens. This exhibition highlights never-before-seen watercolors by British artist-inventor Cornelius Varley. Varley's precise images were captured before the advent of photography in the 19th century, using drawing instruments he invented, which museum visitors are invited to try for themselves. Through the Looking Lens reveals the full breadth of Varley's work at the intersection of history, art, and science. More at apsmuseum.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a former NFL linebacker tries to square his love for the game with the health risks of playing it and asks, would he let his own children play? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It's opening night with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, and special guest Anne-Sophie Mutter. This all-Tchaikovsky opening night features the Violin Concerto and Romeo and Juliet. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999 today. this Wednesday at 7 at the Kimmel Center. Opening night with Anne-Sophie Mutter, Yannick Nézet-Séguin, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about U.S. economic recovery. There are many who might say, what recovery? And we are talking about how real it has been for many people. We're going to be looking at the housing market, at household incomes, and some key indicators of where the economy is 5 years after the financial meltdown of 2008 that led to the Great Recession. We've also been talking about the Federal Reserve and its recent decision to continue its bond buying program to stimulate the economy. There were some signals that the Fed might be pulling back on that program, but not so, according to Wednesday's announcement. We are talking with a couple of experts on these matters. We have with us Binyamin Applebaum, who is Washington correspondent who covers business and economics topics for the New York Times. Jim Tankersley is with us as well. He is economics policy correspondent for The Washington Post. And gentlemen, when we left off, we were talking about the successor, potential successor for Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, that Janet Yellen is the front runner at this point. Binyamin, tell us a little bit about her. How is she different from President Obama's original choice, which was Lawrence Summers, who, as one of you just pointed out, recently took his name out of contention?
Well, they're very different people. Janet Yellen may have more sort of background in preparation for the job of Fed chairman than anyone who's ever held the position. She started serving on the Fed in 1994 and served a first stint of about 3 years back then. Then was one of President Clinton's chief economic advisors, ran the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco for more than half a decade, is an incredibly distinguished academic economist, had a long career at the University of California at Berkeley, and then, you know, returned to the Fed Board in Washington in 2010 as the vice chairman, as one of Ben Bernanke's chief lieutenants. So she sort of had this long record both in economics and in public service, and it viewed as, by many people, as just being incredibly prepared for this job. You know, in terms of her policy priorities, she's actually, you know, pretty similar to Summers in many respects. They both are, you know, from the liberal end of the spectrum. They have a large concern with unemployment and see the Fed as responsible for doing what it can to reduce unemployment and to spur job creation. And, you know, she's been certainly committed to that during her time as the Fed's vice chair. Temperamentally, she's very different than Larry Summers. Summers, who was President Obama's chief economic advisor, is arrogant by many accounts, can be difficult to deal with, has a reputation for being, a hard-driving, argumentative, brilliant, but, you know, at times hard to deal with person. Yellen, by contrast, is, you know, often described as nice by people who know her. She can, like everyone else, be difficult to work with at times, but has much more of a reputation as a consensus builder, as someone who conveys a lot of respect for other people's opinions and is good at working in a committee context. So a lot of people see her as temperamentally well-suited for this job.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in our conversation at 888-477-9499. Forgive me, we are talking about U.S. economic recovery. We'd be interested to know, what has economic recovery looked like or not looked like for you? Perhaps you're an investor and you were a bit taken aback by the news last week from the Fed that the bond buying program is going to continue for at least a little while longer before they begin to taper things off. We'd be interested to hear your experience and your stories as well. Jim Tankersley, there was some question about whether President Obama felt maybe, I don't want to sort of put words in his mouth or characterize this myself, but almost backed into a corner because there's been a lot of pressure about nominating Janet Yellen. And there was some speculation that he might go a different direction for that reason. Is that likely to happen?
All the indications that my colleagues who are reporting this much more closely than I am are getting from the White House is that that is not what's happening right now. That what's happening is that Janet Yellen is in the final stages of being vetted, and that she is being sort of pitched to Democrats in particular on Capitol Hill as the very likely choice here. And I think to sort of go back and unwind the way the administration has been talking about this appointment for a couple of months now, they never made a very strong or even strong at all case out in public overtly against Janet Yellen. It was always a case for Larry Summers. So they spent a lot of time building her up, saying nice things about her. The president mentioned both her and Summers as leading candidates for the job. It would be difficult for them now to turn around and say, nope, sorry, we actually have these huge reservations, unless something comes up. All that said, I think they absolutely have been dealing with some rebellious Senate Democrats on the Banking Committee in particular, and I can imagine that would leave them feeling a little grumpy.
Binyo, what do you say? What's the likelihood of confirmation here? Do you expect it to be a rocky road for her?
I think, you know, she has the Democratic Party solidly behind her. I think, you know, unlike Summers, who faced a lot of them, was ultimately sunk by opposition, both from liberal and from populist Senate Democrats. Yellen appears to command broad support, probably unanimous support from Senate Democrats. And the question then becomes, can she win the support of a couple of Republicans, or at least convince, you know, no Republicans to attempt to filibuster the nomination? Democrats don't have the 60 votes that you need to do business in the modern Senate. And so in order to do anything, they need a little bit of help from their Republican friends. That can be difficult to obtain at times. Either because it gets caught up in other issues, or because there are principled objections to the individual issue, in this case, Yellen's nomination. So I think we just don't know how Republicans are going to respond, how amenable they'll be to this. It certainly could become a little bit complicated. It could revive some of the debates we had earlier this year about whether the process of approving nominees is broken, if indeed Republicans do attempt to block this. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, most people expect she'll be confirmed, you know, with a little bit more or a little bit less trouble.
Before we shift gears and begin to talk specifically about the economic recovery, I want to go to the phones to Springfield, Pennsylvania. And Jim, welcome, Jim, to Radio Times.
Hello. Yes, my question is, where does the Fed get the funds to buy these bonds?
You're talking about the $85 billion a month program that we've been discussing. Binyo,
That's
where does
correct.
That money come from?
Yeah, the Fed has the wonderful and unique power to create money out of thin air. That's the great thing about being the Federal Reserve, is you can actually print, quite literally print money. In this case, they don't actually print new dollar bills, although if you look at the ones in your pocket, you'll see that they're called Federal Reserve notes for the very good reason that the Federal Reserve creates them. In this case, what they do is they credit banks. They credit, so if a bank sells them a bond, they credit the bank's account at the Fed for the amount of the purchase, and the bank then has that money on reserve. But, you know, part of the traditional mechanism by which the Fed stimulates the economy is when it wants, you know, when it wants more economic activity, it increases the amount of money flowing through the economy. It gives people quite literally more money to spend. And in times when it wants to shrink economic activity, it pulls some of that money back out of circulation. This we don't need to get into today. This is one step more complicated. That money is actually not flowing out into the system. It's a common misconception about this, but fundamentally, that's you won't go too far wrong if that's how you understand it.
If only we could all do that, Binyo, correct?
Yeah, indeed. My life would be a lot easier.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We are talking about the U.S. economic recovery and some recent happenings at the Federal Reserve as well. We welcome you to join our conversation at 888-477-9499. Jim Tankersley, how would you characterize the economic recovery 5 years after the meltdown?
I would characterize it as a recovery in very limited nature, with some of historically slow growth and slow job creation for the recovery from a recession. I would characterize it as bifurcated, with a lot, if not all, of the gains from this recovery skewed toward the people at the very top of the income distribution. It's a recovery that has left, you know, almost 12 million people looking for a job and not able to find one still. It's a recovery that has seen median incomes actually fall from the start of the recovery until now. And it's a recovery where the average American absolutely feels like she or he is not getting ahead and is sort of stuck in a very anxious economic situation. So it's not very good, but it's better than when we were in the throes of the recession.
Would you have expected us to be further along by this point in terms of recovery?
It's difficult to say. The policies that have been pursued for the last few years, I think almost everyone would agree that no matter what your preferred policies prescription is, it hasn't been followed. So there has not been a concerted effort on behalf of Washington for some time now to try to boost the recovery and really put a lot more people back to work, not since the early days of the recovery. And I think that that should not surprise us then that the results have been, we've had this sort of like bumping along of low growth where we never can quite kind of achieve escape velocity to the faster, higher growth and really robust job creation we need to start putting a lot of people back to work and pushing up wages again. So I think it's only surprising in that it's not what we've experienced historically until the last couple of recessions, which were also so-called jobless recoveries. But it's not surprising in that we haven't really tried very hard to do much about it in the last few years.
Binu, Jim just pointed out that the recovery, the greatest recovery, really has been seen at the upper echelons of wealth and so forth. And certainly, President Obama has been speaking of late about the middle class, about helping the middle class. There's been sort of a renewed push for that. Is it too little too late at this point, or is there time for something to be done to help the middle class, at least during this administration?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's inherently too little too late in any sense, but I mean, talk is awfully cheap. And I think the thing that I'd point out about this recovery, it's not just that we have a lousy recovery. We also have a long-term problem that we're feeling more acutely right now because it's not being masked by anything like the growth we need. And that long-term problem is that the middle class has been sliding for more than a generation now. We've seen a hollowing out of the types of jobs that used to sustain middle-class families. We've seen this incredible increase in income inequality, as job growth has been primarily at sort of the service end of, you know, Walmart and Target warehouse and McDonald's jobs on the one hand, and Wall Street and hedge fund and private equity on the other hand. And, you know, the people who used to, you know, earn $50,000 a year making things have found that those jobs just don't exist anymore. So we have this huge societal problem with our economy. It's no longer providing for that vast midsection of society. I've seen their actual living standards erode, their income erode, even during periods of growth over the last generation. And now, on top of all of that, we have a huge recession, this huge hit to the economy, and we're only very slowly showing any signs of recovering from it. One of my favorite statistics is that the share of American adults who are actually working has not recovered at all since the recession. It fell by about 5 percentage points during the recession. We haven't gained back any of that. People who, you know, have trouble understanding why it is that economists insist on saying that the recession is over, people who think, as many Americans do, that we're still in recession, they have a point. In a technical sense, we've left the recession behind us. In terms of people's lives, it sure feels awfully present.
How does that square then with unemployment numbers going down to some degree, at least? Because you said that the share of adults actually working has been pretty flat. There really hasn't been recovery, and yet we're seeing some indications that unemployment is getting better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a wonderful question, and it's something I wish was more widely understood. The government's unemployment figure is a count of the number of people who are actively looking for work. If you do not have a job and you think things have gotten so bad that you give up even on trying to find a job, it is the government's view that you should no longer be counted as unemployed. And I hope that that sounds as ridiculous to your listeners as it is, because the consequence is that we can have a world in which many people need jobs, would like to have jobs, and are so hard up that they can't even, you know, begin the process of finding them. And it can look as if our economy is getting better if you're following the unemployment rate.
So you're talking about the discouraged worker category, it sounds like.
Yeah, discouraged workers, or people who've gone back to school, or people who retired early because, you know, they just figured it wasn't going to get better, or people who decided to stay home and raise their children because that has started to seem, you know, economically more reasonable than it did previously. Vast swaths of the population who, you know, in better economic times would be actively seeking work, have left the job market entirely. As a consequence, the unemployment rate is declining, but characterizing that as an economic recovery is a little hard to do.
Jim Tankersley, will this be the new normal for us in the United States, that recovery from economic setbacks is going to have a jobless nature to it, as Binya pointed out, that it's going to take longer, perhaps, than it used to?
So on this, sort of uncharacteristically for me, I am an optimist. I don't think it has to be the new normal, but I do think that it is the new normal. There's a lot of academic research right now looking into this question. Some of it, a paper that came out earlier this year, says that our shift to a service economy, an economy where we do things for each other and not make things, is actually making it harder, making it take longer for jobs to come back for a lot of reasons. Another paper, which I just wrote about this last week, says that the United States is starting to behave more like what we think of as Europe, which with longer, slower recoveries that feel jobless. And the really discouraging thing about that paper was they tested a whole bunch of possible explanations for why that was, and they couldn't figure it out. So this is a big mystery. Why has the U.S. economy sort of ground much slower now than it was in previous recoveries? There are a lot of theories on it. None of them seem to adequately explain it. And so I think it's obviously and importantly a job of policymakers and economists to try to figure that out and try to start responding to it. But what makes me pessimistic is we're not getting to that level of discussion. We're not even getting to the level of discussion of what should we be doing now to help the economy. And Binya is absolutely right about the way that the unemployment rate falling has sort of blunted some of the concern in Washington about this. It's the number one statistic that policymakers respond to, and they feel better about things because that rate's going down, even though it looks by and large to be a function of people dropping out of the labor force.
So what are the unemployment numbers right now? What percentage of Americans are unemployed? Jim.
So I think it's hovering around 7.5%, and what it is it's a little less than 12 million Americans, which is how I like to think about it, who all want to find a job and can't. Those are the people who are actively looking for work, so the government still counts them as unemployed. And I think it's still like a third of those workers are classified as long-term unemployed, which means they've been looking for at least 6 months for a job and not able to find one. This is a really big problem because those are people who have not grown so discouraged yet that they've dropped out of the labor force but are still looking and not able to find work. And eventually, what economics would tell us is that if we can't find enough economic activity to generate jobs for those people to take, they will become basically unemployable. And the U.S. economy will lose some potential output, some potential growth, some possibilities of getting better because those folks just won't fit into the labor force anymore.
Jim Binya pointed out a few moments ago that so many of the jobs that are coming back, if you will, are low-income jobs. You mentioned McDonald's and so forth. Why is that, that so many of the jobs that are being created are not really jobs that are able to, where people are able to contribute strongly to the economy, to the tax base, et cetera?
Well, it's actually a little more complicated than that. There are a lot of jobs, and the big growth is coming at that bottom end. And not only are those jobs coming at the bottom end, but there's so many of them, and there's so many workers who are being forced to take those jobs that it's pushing down wages. Very simple, the demand to work in those jobs is really high, so the supply of wages for you to work in it falls. So that's bad. You're now actually making less in real dollars to go work in fast food than you were a few years ago. On the other hand, there are jobs being created at the very, very top of the economy, really high-skilled jobs, engineering jobs, sort of high-end knowledge economy jobs. And we've seen that in the statistics, too. The problem is there's nothing in that broad middle, or there's a lot less than there used to be.
We are talking about the U.S. economic recovery with a couple of experts in that field. We're talking with Binyamin Applebaum and Jim Tankersley, and we will be back with more and your questions when Radio Times comes right back.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
The creative process. It comes easily for some, and it's complicated for others. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, what's part and parcel of our creative process, and what gets in the way of it? We'll hear from Barry Panter, founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference, local author Rachel Simon, and writer Andrew Schaefer. His book, Literary Rogues, came out earlier this year. Voices in the Family, today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Friends School Haverford is a co-ed Quaker school for preschool through 8th grade, located in Haverford, Pennsylvania, minutes from Center City, offering rigorous academics and a commitment to challenging each student in every subject. A micro-farm with egg-laying hens and a social curriculum based on respect and kindness are just a few of the hallmarks of their program. An open house will be held on Saturday, October 5th from 9 to 11 a.m. Details at friendshaverford.org. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. We're talking about the U.S. economic recovery, and we are talking with Benjamin Applebaum, who is the Washington correspondent who covers business and economic topics for the New York Times. Jim Tankersley is economics policy correspondent for the Washington Post. We welcome your questions as well, your comments. What has economic recovery looked like for you these last 5 years? The number to join our conversation is 888-477-9499. And gentlemen, we did have a caller who was unable to remain on the line with us for an answer to this question, and that is, how are these discouraged workers that we talked about, people who have been looking for quite some time now and maybe are just out of the mix, how are they identified? Binya?
I mean, how does the government figure out that someone has left
the
work? So the government... The basic metric here is a survey that the government does. It actually literally goes to the homes of, you know, hundreds and thousands of Americans each month and knocks on the door and interviews people. The Census Bureau does this, interviews people about their work, whether they are working, whether they're not working, about the conditions of employment, and then follows up with those same families over the course of several subsequent months. That is the basis for the official statistics that the government reports. That's how it figures out how many people. It's sort of a huge national poll or survey. How many people are working? How many people are working part-time? How many people have withdrawn from the labor force? And it extrapolates from that survey to develop figures for the nation as a whole. That data, we have other sources of data that speak to the same question. We know, for example, how many people are receiving unemployment or jobless benefits. We can see, you know, in other forms of government data, some of the same numbers that you know, can be used to sort of cross-reference this basic data, but at the core, it's a national survey.
Jim Tankersley, I want to talk about household incomes not going up. And according to what I've read, the Census Bureau data shows that median household income adjusted for inflation is no higher now than it was in the late 80s. Is that true? And if so, why is that?
It's true, and it speaks to just how bad the 2000s were as a decade economically. I mean, I think this is something that we miss because so much happened. I mean, first off, what happened at the end of the 80s was we had a little recession, and then we went up and had the boom 90s. When incomes did go up, if you look at this, it's not just a flat line from 1989 to now. Incomes went up, but then the bubble burst, and we had a recession, and this is where the problems really start. The recovery, the 2001 recovery, was historically anemic, and it was really bad for median incomes also, and it was, to the extent that it even existed, largely fueled by a housing bubble, which then burst again, and we had a financial crisis, and then suddenly we had this great recession, and so the combined effects of a really lame decade for economic growth and income growth, and then a deep plunge from the second recession of the decade has now delivered, at the end of a second really, really bad recovery historically, it has delivered us to this point where the median income today is the same after you adjust for inflation as it was in 1989.
I want to go back to the phones to Westchester and MJ. Welcome, MJ, to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. My question is about the retirement crisis and the possibility of individuals, older individuals, staying in the workforce longer, and whether or not this change is having a significant effect on the overall ability for people to get into the workforce and to become upwardly mobile.
Jim Tankersley, what do you say?
There is an effect that I think we're starting to see where older people are hanging around in their jobs for longer. There's also an effect at the same time where people who were maybe a little bit short of retirement age, I think, Ben, you referenced this earlier, have lost their jobs and found it really hard to find another one. And so some of them are just retiring early. So the effects are there, and I think it's absolutely worrisome if you're someone coming out of college right now trying to find your way into a very crowded labor market. But it's probably not the dominant effect at the moment, and we know this because participation, which the number of people working, the percentage of people working among workers in their primes, age 25 to mid-50s, is falling also. So it's not just that older people are sticking around or that younger people are having a hard time making it in. It's that we are losing workers in that middle section too. And so that's maybe a more important effect than the important retirement effect you just described.
Back to the phones, we go to Atlantic City, New Jersey, and Al. Welcome to Radio Times, Al.
Hello. My understanding is basically is that you're telling me the rich are getting richer, that the middle class is shrinking. You didn't mention the poor. I'm guessing the poor, you're just saying the same, or they're growing. I have a very simple question. What are you going to do to remedy this?
Well, that is the $64 million question, Al, isn't it? Binya, what do you say? What's the solution to the situation we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I don't know that there are easy solutions to the situation that we find ourselves in. Jim made a point a little while ago that neither political party has been able to implement its economic agenda in full. Neither party, they both have ideas about how to improve the economy, but they're at loggerheads. And, as a consequence, we've ended up with, a muddle, pieces of both agendas. And in many senses, we've ended up with the worst of what both party wants for the economy, what each party wants for the economy. And the consequences have been predictably bad. But there are lots of ideas about how to improve the economy. Improving the quality of education is one that many economists believe holds tremendous promise. We are not doing a good job of educating kids in usable skills. Our system for, helping people who are not maybe going to complete a bachelor's degree, find vocational skills is pretty attenuated in this country. There are ideas for improving the quality of the workforce that might have a measurable impact over time. There are people who believe that our relationship with, our trading partners needs to change, that globalization has been an engine for some of this disruption in ways that are not wholly positive, and that America needs to reconsider the value of manufacturing and of making things here. That's been something the Obama administration has emphasized in its second term to some extent. And there are lots of other ideas as well. I don't know that any of them are a magic bullet. But the beginning point, the basic thing that needs to happen for any of those things to happen is that our political process needs to become functional again, because we certainly can't embark on any of these solutions in a world in which the two parties can't even agree, on a federal budget.
Jim, what do you say? What needs to happen to get us out of the mess we're in?
Well, I would say that there's a lot that needs to happen long term, but the simplest, and this is deceptively simple, but the simplest thing that needs to happen short term is we need to get back to what's called full employment. We need growth at a fast enough rate and job creation at a fast enough rate that basically everybody who wants a job can find one with some reasonable frictions for looking for a job. And if you do that, if you have the sort of labor market that looks a lot more like the 90s than the one we've had for the last several years, then you are going to end up with more benefits flowing down the scale. It's just a simple fact that if not everybody is looking for a job in fast food, then the wages are going to start going up at the jobs where people are finding them. And this is a point that gets lost on a lot of policymakers, but this isn't good enough, the growth we have now, in part because it doesn't empower the people who are working in the economy. It's not just about the people who are looking for work. You need to get those people back to work so that we can empower everyone to do better.
Jim, how would you characterize the housing market right now?
The housing market remains one of the very few success stories of the economy, which is a really weird thing to be saying, given that a couple of years ago it may have been the biggest drag on the economy. And there's more activity to come probably still with the housing market. There's probably going to be, over the next few years, somewhat of an uptick in construction, somewhat more of an uptick in small business borrowing, for people who finally get equity back in their houses and so they can take out a loan from the bank to start a new business. but it's not enough, and it has suffered from the Fed's back and forth on quantitative easing and the tapering, which is that the spike in or the run-up in mortgage rates may be having some kind of an effect on the pace of the housing recovery.
I'd like to ask both of you about the outlook for college graduates, and one of you, I think it was Jim, mentioned them just a moment ago, but we've done lots of shows on, you know, first of all, the high cost of tuition, and then you've got these graduates coming out who are burdened typically with a lot of debt and then difficulty finding a job. What do each of you think about the prognosis for college graduates over the next 5 to 10 years? And Binya, I'll start with you.
There has never been a better time to be a college graduate. It has never been more economically important in the United States to be a college graduate. If you look at the disparity between lifetime earnings for a college graduate and a person who does not graduate from college, that gap has never been larger. Unemployment for college graduates in this country is 3.5%. It's less than half the rate for everyone else. And there's just overwhelming evidence that the importance of having the advanced skills that you acquire through a college education and the certification that you acquire through a college education has simply never been more important as a prerequisite for entering the part of the economy that is actually working and actually productive and actually employing people. So I understand that there's a great deal of concern about the cost of college, and there ought to be. It's a big problem, and it's one that we need to address as a society. But for people who are able to make that investment, for people who are able to get through that door, it remains a tremendously smart and lucrative and important investment, and our concerns about the cost of college ought to be focused primarily on the people who can't get through that door as a consequence. How do we help more people obtain these skills and this training? Because it's simply never been more important. I spoke a little bit earlier about the sense that education is probably the single greatest thing we can do to improve our economic prospects. College obviously is a big piece of that. Helping more people get the college educations they need to succeed is a big piece of that. But, you know, when I hear college graduates complaining about their economic situation, there obviously are reasons to complain, but relative to everyone else, they happen to be doing great.
Well, by the way, that is very much what we'll be talking about tomorrow on Radio Times at 10. We'll be talking about the state of higher education and many of the issues that Binya just raised. Jim, what's your outlook for college grads?
So I did a magazine piece for the Washington Post magazine this summer, trying to give some advice to college freshmen and people who are just starting off their higher educational careers this year. I talked to a lot of college admissions counselors and to a lot of economists to ask the question, okay, what should people who are going to make this investment in college do to try to maximize that investment in terms of getting a job? And they came back with a really simple and strong answer, I thought, which was it matters a little less what you major in and a lot more what sort of skills you pick up. And the most important thing you can do right now in this economy, if you're a college student, is figure out ways to make yourself different than a robot. Give yourself the sort of problem-solving skills, working with people skills, cognitive, handling difficult tasks, multitasking kind of skills that you just can't automate or you can't outsource to a less skilled laborer who's making less money in another country. That whether you're an English major or an engineering major, that's going to help you fit much better into this future workforce that we all think we're headed toward and that we're in many ways already into now. And so I think in that regard, it's a bright prospect because most of the young people I know going into college are incredibly, incredibly driven to pick up those kinds of skills because it's just the world they live in now.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones very, very quickly to South Philly and Allie. Allie, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, my question has to do with, you know, there are so many people who are working full-time but still living in poverty or just above the poverty line. I was wondering if the guest could speak a little bit to the impact of raising the minimum wage.
And what would be the impact on our recovery? Is that your question?
Right, of raising the minimum wage.
Okay. Well, thank you, Allie. Gentlemen, what do you say?
Well, the research on the minimum wage is really varied. Absolutely, the research would suggest that it helps people who are toiling at that very, very bottom end of the scale. And like I said, there's been downward rate wage pressure on those people lately. And the real minimum wage, if you index it for inflation, is done much worse than even the real median income. So the question would be, how many jobs would you end up pushing out of the workforce by people deciding, okay, I can't pay an extra dollar an hour for a worker here at this fast food restaurant, so I'm going to put computers in as the interface with customers instead of people. That's a big question that the really polite way of saying it is a lot of economists disagree very, very violently about.
Well, I just note by way of context that it's important to understand that whatever one thinks about the minimum wage, the trend over the last generation, and it is part of this broader economic trend, is that in inflation-adjusted terms, the federal minimum wage has plummeted. And so we are requiring employers to pay much less money to their workers than we once did. If you think that's great, so be it. If you think that's a problem, so be it. But just to frame this debate, it's not just a question of whether we should raise the minimum wage. It's a question of whether we even want to bring it back to where it was in, say, 1980.
Great point. One last question in our last 60 seconds or so. Jim, what should the average American, if there is such a person, expect over the next year or two?
I think the average American should hope that things don't get worse. And that would obviously come back to what we were talking about at the beginning with Washington. The average American should hope that her or his member of Congress is able to work with the other party to avoid a catastrophic default on our national debts.
Binyu, what do you say?
You know, I hate to close on a sobering note, but if you look historically over the last 100 years in America, this is about as long as we go between recessions. I know it doesn't feel like it's been a recovery to people, but summer ends at some point, and, you know, it's not out of the realm of probability that we're going to be getting closer to another turn in the business cycle. Historically speaking, we are running out the clock on this recovery.
So there is a lot to look for, a lot to be following your work and to see where the economy goes over the next year or two, particularly what's going to happen in Washington come October 1. Will we have a shutdown or will we not? That is a big question. I want to thank our guests for being with us. Jim Tankersley is economics policy correspondent for The Washington Post. Binyamin Applebaum is a Washington correspondent who covers business and economic topics for the New York Times. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And I am Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.